I suspect that most of those who are here today who are a first-generation Christian, they'll recall the details of what happened when they first heard about true Christianity. And every one of us has a unique story that we can relate as to how we came to know the truth. And each one of us has a story that's very personal to us. We may remember the time and place, or we may remember the people involved, but each one of us has our own experience. But not everyone who's heard the truths of God has chosen to go the way that God has called them to do. The way we are to go is a journey. And the way is a direction that our decisions take us, because our lives are that journey. And as we make choices, the consequences of those choices point us in the direction of the way. Well, today I'm going to look at two people in the Bible who had an opportunity to follow the teachings of God. And we're going to look at how and when they resisted God and how different their lives became in their approach to the truths of God. We're going to compare and contrast their lives and see how we can avoid the pitfalls and emulate or copy their successes. What is amazing is that these two people have the same name. Today's message is entitled, Comparing the Two Sauls. First, I'd like to take a look at a man named Saul, a Roman Jew. He was trained in the law and became a persecutor of Christians. Books have been written about the life of this Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul. Many sermons and articles have been created to show all about his life. Books have been written. The apostolic journeys, maps have been made of those. Paul's letters, the epistles. Saul was later called Paul. The epistles are studied each year and in colleges. Well, my purpose today is not to give an exhaustive exposition of the life and the works of the Apostle Paul in the next 45 minutes. Instead, we're going to take a look at some of the known facts that this Saul, who became Paul, and compare and contrast him with the information that we gather about another Saul, the King Saul, the Saul who was the first king of Israel about 1,000 years before the Paul of the New Testament. The Saul of the New Testament, later called Paul, was born in Tarsus of Cilicia. They call it Anatoly, which is what today is known as Turkey. At that time, the Romans had established the Roman Empire and controlled most, if not all, of the countries near the Mediterranean Sea. We know that some of the history of this Saul because he told us, and it's recorded in the Bible, particularly starting in Acts 22 in verses 27 and 28. And this is an occasion when there was a near riot, a mob situation in Jerusalem, and the people there were looking to do great harm to one called Paul, who was earlier called Saul. A Roman commander came and removed Paul from the mob and arrested him and hauled him away. In Acts 22, verse 27, then the commander came to him and said, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He, meaning Paul, said, "Yes." Verse 28, the commander answered, "With a large sum, I obtained this citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." You see, you could obtain citizenship by paying a fee, or you could obtain it by reason of birth. And we know that Paul was a Roman citizen because he said so. Not only was this Paul or Saul a Roman citizen, he was also a Jew. He was born to Jewish parents, and he studied the law under the noted legal teacher Gamaliel. In Acts 22, verse 3, Paul writes, Indeed, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. So this Saul was a very learned man. He spoke both Greek and Hebrew. We know this because there was an incident where Saul was about to suffer at the hands of that Jerusalem mob, and the Romans hauled him off. Now, bear in mind that the Roman Empire ruled in the area at that time. They also ruled Egypt. The main language of the ruling elite of Egypt was Greek. That was left over from the days when Alexander the Great conquered the area. And in Acts 21, and I'm going to, Acts 21 and starting in verse 37, I'm going to read this from the Young Life translation. And Paul, being about to be led into the castle, said to the chief captain, "Is it permitted to me to say something to you?" And he, meaning the chief captain, said, "Greek, dost thou know?" It's in other words, he was saying, "Whoa, you know Greek? Here it is. He's responding to this military man. And Acts 21, continuing on in verse 38. Are you not then the Egyptian who before these days made an uprising and did lead into the desert 4,000 men? So the Roman captain is saying, you know, we've got somebody here. This is one that's causing all kinds of trouble. Verse 39, Paul said, indeed, I am a man, a Jew of Tarsus, of no mean city, a good-sized city. And I beseech you, suffer me to speak to the people. Well, now there's a mob that would like to do him in. And yet this Paul said he would like to speak to the mob. I don't know that I would have a courage to do that, but he did at that time. And then in Acts 21, verse 40, having given him leave, meaning from the Roman soldier, Paul, having stood upon the stairs, did beckon by hand to the people, and there having been a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, men and brothers, hear my defense now to you. And having heard that in Hebrew dialect that he was speaking to them, gave more silence. Whoa, they were surprised. He was speaking in Greek to the Roman, yet he was speaking in Hebrew to them. So, by his own admission, this Saul, later called Paul, persecuted Christians. Saul repeated his admission of guilt. We read that in Acts 26, verses 9 through 11. What does Paul say? Indeed, I thought myself I must do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. This I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. And I punished them often in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly enraged against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. This is the Saul that we're reading about, that the Bible is speaking of, who later became Paul. This Paul was the one who consented to the death of Stephen, the deacon who was persecuted for being a follower of Jesus Christ. Stephen gave a sermon. We read it in Acts 7. And I won't read the whole sermon, but I'll just give the aftermath of it. Because you see, Stephen's sermon was rather direct. And it ended with this in Acts 7, verses 51, starting in 51. Imagine somebody preaching a sermon and telling you this. You stiff-necked and uncircumcised in hearts and ears. You always resist the Holy Spirit as your father did. So do you. Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? Which, of course, they all did. They killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers, who have received the law by the direction of angels and have not kept it. He said, you've all gotten the law, the truth, and yet you then have turned your back on it and made life difficult and even murdered the Just One. So imagine standing up in front of a bunch of people who wished you harm and saying these words. Can you imagine the fury of those who were angered by what Stephen had to say? Well, Stephen stood up and he spoke up to the truth to those in authority who resisted God. And the people heard the word of God, but they resisted. They made noise and covered their ears so they couldn't hear more of what Stephen said concerning the truth. Acts 7, verse 54. When they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, meaning it pricked their conscience. And they gnashed at him with their teeth. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God and said, look, I see the heavens open and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. They cried aloud with a loud voice, stopped up their ears and ran at him with one accord. Now, perhaps you have, but I've seen it in person where somebody just didn't want to hear something and all of a sudden they lapse into la 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 la, and they don't want to hear. They want to drown out what they don't want to hear. Maybe they can't stand it. They have whatever it is very offensive. It's distressing to them. And then we read here that this is literally what people did to try to drown it out. Acts 7, verse 58, and they cast him, meaning Stephen, out of the city and stoned him. And the witnesses laid down their clothes in front of a young man named Saul. And they stoned Stephen as he was calling on God, saying, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And he knelt down and cried out with a loud voice, Lord, do not charge him with this sin. And when he said this, he fell asleep, meaning he died. And then we go immediately to the next verse in Acts 8, verse 1. Now, Saul was consenting to his death. As it, we read earlier, he said, you know, I was very much a persecutor of these Christians. Verse 3 in Acts 8, verse 3, as for Saul, he made havoc of the church, entering every house and dragging off men and women, committing them to prison. One of the chief resistors to the message brought by Jesus Christ and delivered by, and the message delivered by Christ's followers, the chief resistor, one of those, was Saul the Roman Jew, a man who was powerful and learned, a man who chased down the followers of Christ, thinking he did God a favor by persecuting the Christians to their deaths. But it wasn't enough to persecute only the Christians in Jerusalem. Saul went far beyond Jerusalem. He explained in his own words what he did in Acts 22, starting in verse 4. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women. Also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, from whom I also received letters to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains even those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished. So he was going to come and haul them off, go a long distance away and find those Christians who believed in the way, and then bring them back in chains who were throwing into prison in Jerusalem. But what happened on that day, on that road to Damascus, changed history for Saul, and certainly for many people who heard him and read his writings thereafter. And we go on to read about this intervention in Acts 9 about Saul being struck down on the way to Damascus. In Acts 9, verse 3, he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly a light shone around him from the heaven. And he fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And he, meaning Saul, said, who are you, Lord? Meaning anybody who has that much power must be their master. Then the Lord said, I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting. It is hard for you to kick against the goads. Well, that's from the New King James Version. The NIV and some other translations leave out that ending statement about kicking against the goads. The King James Version words it very similarly in Acts 9, verse 5. And he, meaning Paul, said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus, whom you persecute. It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In Young's literal translation, it reads, hard for thee at the pricks to kick. Well, what does this mean, kicking against the pricks or the goads? Why is kicking against the pricks or the goads such a bad thing? If we look back in history at the time of the judges and the Philistines, if we look back in history, we will see that time when the Philistines or other enemies would conquer the people of Israel. And what did they do? The first thing they did was they instituted arms control. In one episode in particular, we recall the story of Samson. I'm sure you've heard of Samson, one of the many judges of ancient Israel. And when the people of Israel were captured by the Philistines, they didn't have weapons to fight. They couldn't fight back to overthrow their oppressor. And they didn't have weapons. Not only didn't they have weapons, they couldn't have iron tools, because those iron tools could be made into weapons. In Judges 14, and I will paraphrase it, that we read that Samson had taken a Philistine wife. But his father-in-law later gave away Samson's wife to someone else. In his anger, Samson captured 300 foxes. Now, just right there, now I've seen a fox. I've seen a couple of foxes, and never together. I've seen them individually. I've seen them crouch down next to the road, waiting for some little gopher or something to pop out and jump onto. I have a hard time imagining capturing one fox, particularly if it were 3,000 years ago or whatever the time was then. But he captured 300 foxes. And then he did something I also have a hard time imagining. He tied them two by two together by their tails. Now, I did see a guy holding a fox once, not too long ago at a farm supply store, and he had it like on a little kitty or dog collar, and he was holding the fox, a young kit. But a wild one I would have a hard time imagining, holding one long enough to tie its tail to another one. And now that he had them tied together, what he did is he caught the 300 fox And then he tied a burning torch to the tied foxtails and turned them loose into standing fields of wheat. Well, the wheat fields, when they're ripe, are very dry, and they can catch fire quite easily. The fields of wheat then burned up many acres. Can you imagine 300, be 150 pairs of fox, all running with, and not running in a straight line, I'm sure, in circles, each fighting each other, spreading the fire around. So they couldn't run off and hide. The opposition would be with the other one, and they would stay in the wheat field and fight. And the wheat fields were burned up of the Philistines, along with the olive groves and vineyards. As you can imagine, the Philistines were pretty angry about this, especially the people that had the fields. And the men of Judah were also very upset. Judges 15, verse 11. 3,000 men of Judah went where Samson was hiding. And they said, "Didn't you know that the Philistines rule over us? Why did you do this? What are you going to do to us now? Basically, we can't defend ourselves. You've gone and done this dastardly thing." Because the Philistines were exacting tribute from Israel at that time. They took money and tribute or goods from Israel, but they didn't allow any metal armaments or metal tools or methods of sharpening metal tools to the Israelites. And if we look in 1 Samuel 13, verse 19, "Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. For Philistines said, 'Lest the Hebrews make swords or spears.'" Verse 20, "But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for sharpening was a unit of currency for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, the axes, and to set the points of the goads." There's that word again, the goads. Well, these instruments are metal instruments. If you wanted to sharpen them or maintain them, you had to take them to the Philistines, because the Philistines also had all the grinding stones that were kept to sharpen things up. And no blacksmith was permitted, and so they had control over the metalworks. Ultimately, Samson was confronted by the Philistines for this great disaster to their crops. And in confrontation, Samson rose up against the Philistines. Now, he wasn't armed, but he was a mighty man. And we read in Judges 15:15, this is the Amplified version. "He," meaning Samson, "found a fresh jawbone of a donkey." So I'm going to guess that's about a foot and a half long, something like that, if you examine a real donkey and imagine it. "And reached out and took his hand and killed 1,000 men with it." You see, Samson didn't have a sword. He didn't have a spear or other weapons, but he used the weapon that he could find, the jawbone of a donkey, and he made use of it. So that was standard operating procedure, by the way, is to disarm your enemies. I mean, it's been done for thousands of years. I mean, it's been done in the last century, where countries have been disarmed and then they have suffered great slaughter. And we can go down the list, from Lenin and Stalin to kill 20 to 40 million of their own people. Same thing in China, 30 to 40 million of their own people. Adolf Hitler killed, 6 to 7 million Jews and 6 to 7 million more of other people. Pol Pot in Cambodia, up to 7 million people he killed. So it's not uncommon for an occupying force or totalitarian leaders to disarm people and cause them great harm. But they included in this little prick or this goad. Jesus Christ said it's hard to kick against the pricks or hard to kick against the goads. So I want you to work with me with this imagination, with your imagination. If you have an ox pulling a cart, sometimes the ox doesn't want to go forward. It would rather just back up and do its own thing. So what people with an ox cart would do is they would put sharp points on the front of the cart. And then if the ox backed up into the cart, it would back its hind end into the sharp points, and that would help to change the oxen's mind about backing up, and they would generally then go forward. But you see, if the tips were simply made of sharpened wood, an ox can be anywhere from 1 to 3,000 pounds. Now, a yearling, maybe, at least nowadays, is about 1,000 pounds. A two-year-old can be 2,000 pounds or more. I've seen a 3,000-pound oxen 6 feet tall at the shoulders. In fact, I saw it while it was a bull, and I had the uncomfortable displeasure of leading it by a ring in the nose. Talk about being, my arms could not fit around the neck. And so they go wherever they want to go. But if you put the goads behind them, they aren't going to be going backwards. So the principle is the same, regardless of the size of the ox. If it backs up and feels a poking sensation in their backside, they're more likely to go forward. The goads can also be carried out by their handlers in the form of a stick with a metal goad. And if they want to go one way, they will be poked along to go in the correct direction. So, can you imagine what good would it do if an oxen were to simply kick at the goads? Would be unsuccessful. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't stop the goads from hurting when it kicks it. Now, some of you have been raised with cattle on the farm like I have, and you know that some cattle don't listen very well, just like some people don't. And the cattle don't go forward when you want them to at all times. Well, we had a beef feedlot, and we'd load up the cattle in a trailer, and we'd squeeze them up to get the most number of cattle in the trailer, and sometimes one of them would leave a foot sticking out in the back. You just couldn't get the trailer closed. Well, my father pulled out the modern equivalent of a goad. He would, which consisted of about 5D batteries and an electric prod. And if they were zapped on the foot or the ankle, it's really surprising how fast they could decide to pick that foot up, push 10,000 pounds of cattle in front of them forward, and get onto the trailer. Well, that's a modern-day goad. In the ancient times, it didn't have batteries and electric sensations for the cattle. There are other examples that we use to keep people from backing up. In a previous occupation, I used to travel a lot for a living. And I would go through airports all over the country and rent a car. And the car rental agencies, and I've noted they still do, they have several entrances, but only one exit. And every place that you could get into the lot, they would generally have spring-loaded prongs that if you drove in, they would lie down. But if you tried to come out, they would puncture the tires and leave them all flat. Only in one place could you drive out without the prongs, and that's where it was a controlled, restricted place where they could check to make sure you actually rented the car and were not stealing it. Most car rental places, they leave all the keys in them, so they don't have to go hunt and find the keys. But they have a restricted exit. But let's go back to our original story in Acts 9, and verse 5, about Saul, meaning Paul, being struck down with a bright light on the road to Damascus. Nobody is suggesting that Saul or Paul was actually kicking against cattle goads that it was spoken of here, or that somebody was actually poking him with a literal goad, just as the oxen would not back up because of the goads behind them. But it's rhetorically in that people should not resist when they're pointed in the direction that they should go. I'd like to just take a quick glance at an extremely short verse in the Bible. Only three words in Luke 17, verse 32. In the NIV, it says it in three words. Remember Lot's wife. This short verse tells us it's not a good idea to back up. Don't go back. There's another aspect then about kicking against the pricks. And having been raised on a dairy farm, there were 38 cows in the barn, and they were all face to face. There was a manger. You could throw hay in front of them and grain, and they would share in that manger and eat back and forth. And behind them would be an aisle, and the cows would stay in the barn all winter, maybe outside for about an hour a day to exercise. And the cats were no dummies. They wanted the warm place to lie down or to go. They would go in the barn. They weren't going to stay outside. And so there was a day where I happened to be nearby, and there was a cat that was looking for a place to lie down. Cow was standing up. And as a cow standing up all day long, they would rock a little from side to side. And every once in a while, they would just step, lift their foot maybe an inch and slide over a little bit. The cat was walking between the cow's legs. And as a cat's tail went swishing from side to side, the tip of the tail went under the hoof of the cow right at the very moment she was moving over. Well, this is a direct line to the brain that we have instant pain. The cat doesn't know why. And so what does a cat do? It attacks what it's attacking it. And it rears up, screams on its legs. You hear this terrible noise. I mean, I'm 4 or 5 feet away. I'm seeing this in living color. And it attacks the thing that's hurting it, which is the leg of the cow. The cow, of course, is completely oblivious because there's no feeling in the hoof. It doesn't know it's stepping on the cat's tip of the cat's tail. And so this cow then has these claws of this cat sticking into the leg, and it does, it's in a stanchion, it can't go anywhere. So it does the only thing it can do, it tries to shake the cat off of its leg. The cat is screaming. The cow is bellowing. The cat is hanging on for dear life. The cow is kicking even harder to get rid of this screaming cat. Eventually, they both became exhausted. The cat fell off, and the cow was exhausted. But you see, it was the cow was responding to this sharp prick. It knew something was terribly wrong, just like the cat was responding to this sharp pain. And so this response, we can imagine, is like what happens in our lives from time to time. We don't always know what's going on, but there's some sharp prod or goad that's hurting us. In Acts 9:5, Jesus Christ admonished Saul to quit kicking against the pricks. And of course, then let's read about how this was described. In the New Life version of the Bible, it's slightly reworded in Acts 9, verses 4 or 5. Then he, Paul or Saul, fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you working so hard against me?" Saul answered, "Who are you, Lord?" He said, "I am Jesus, the one who you are working against. You hurt yourself trying to hurt me." As a boy, I was playing in the yard with my brother. We were elementary school students. But I was a little kid. It was too hard to hit a softball, so he thought he'd make it easy for me and bring out a basketball. So I had a bat and a basketball. Great idea if you're an elementary kid. And that would be easier to hit. And in fact, I used the bat and hit the basketball. But I did not have a full knowledge of the laws of physics at that time. And so when I swung at that bat for all it was worth, and the bat smacked into the ball, and I did a great job. I was proud of myself for a fraction of a second. But that's when I got learned in the laws of physics that there was the inertia of a basketball was greater than the mass and inertia of a softball bat. Now, it did split open my eyebrow and a great deal of blood, and it meant a hospital or a trip to the doctor to get sewed up. I didn't realize what I was doing was going to hurt me. Saul didn't know at the time what he was going to do to hurt Christians was actually hurting himself as well. Let's take a look then we'll look at it in the Amplified Bible. Classic Edition has yet another wording. And Acts 9 and verse 5, "And Saul said, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said, 'I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. It's dangerous, and it will turn out badly for you to keep kicking against the goad.'" Parentheses, "to offer vain and perilous resistance." So if we continue on with the narrative in verses 6 and 7 and so forth, what did Paul do? He trembled and was astonished and says, "What do you want me to do?" Well, that's a reasonable question. I'm on the ground. I'm blinded. You've struck me down. You have my attention. Isn't that what happens to each of us at some point in life? God has our attention. So during the conversion process, we ask God, "What do you want me to do?" And in Acts 9, went on and it talked about what was expected of him, but he was blinded, went for 3 days without food and water. Now you can live about 3 days without anything to drink, but after that your tongue's pretty wooden and I think you expire. So he was taken right to the limit. And then, interestingly enough, in Acts 9, verses 10 through 12, what happens is he was taken to the house of Ananias, one of the very people he came to either kill or haul back in chains to Jerusalem. And it was Ananias then that we read on that anointed his eyes, who then allowed him sight. So so that occasion was that Saul, then not yet named Paul, was blind for 3 days, had nothing to eat, nothing to drink, limited understanding, in what the world was going to happen to you, but you had a pretty good idea that a deity had spoken to you. Would you pray? In verse 11, and we read, when the Lord said to him, arise and go to the street called Straight and inquire at the home of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus, for he is praying. So here's this Saul who is persecuting Christians. And Ananias was told, you'll find him. He's the guy over there praying at this certain house. Wouldn't we all about that time? So, and then, of course, we read that he had received food and went on to be the become the Paul that that we know from many other stories in the Bible. The there is then a Paul that had this Paul was named Saul, was later called Paul. There was another Saul in the Bible. And this man was also selected by God, and this Saul was selected to be the first king over the nation of Israel. Now, this was during the period of the judges, and the people of Israel were occupied by their enemies, and so the people of Israel wanted a king to rule over them. And so, because all the other countries had a king, well, why don't they have a king? Well, periodically, God would raise up a judge and throw off the rascals that were trying or had to rule over them. But they decided they wanted a king just like everybody else. And Samuel, of course, cried out to God. And God said, don't worry. You know, they're not rejecting you as the prophet. They're rejecting me as their God. And we read this story in First Samuel 8, starting in verse 6, and reads on. I'm not going to read it all. But Samuel warned them what a king would do. And this is valid to this day, that what would a king do? And here's the behavior, he says in verse 11. He will rule over, take your sons and daughters, and appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen. Some, meaning of your sons and daughters, will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and over his fifties. Some will plow his ground and reap his harvest, some to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. In other words, make them his personal servants. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. In other words, he's going to redistribute your wealth often to him. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys, and put them to work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of the king whom you've chosen for yourselves. Well, they were making the decision, and it was not going to turn out well for them. But the people, we read on in verse 19, nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel and said, no, we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so, God said, fine, give him a king. We read that in verse 22. And Israel says, okay, everybody go home. I'll work on it. And so he goes on and it talks about in 1 Samuel 9, 15 through 17, that he finds a young man named Saul. And it says, God told Samuel in his ear, whispered, meaning 1 Samuel 9, verse 15. It says, there will be somebody here that I'm going to send you from the land of Benjamin. You'll make him commander over the people. And then you will have a king. And so he went out to look for this man. Samuel went out to look for this man named Saul, and he was out hunting for donkeys at the time. You know, again, I grew up on the farm, and sometimes livestock would get out. What a pain. They got out all the time. Why? And we're out hunting them down, trying to chase them and get them home. And Saul was doing the same thing, hunting down the livestock that had gotten away. And if we read in 1 Samuel 9, verse 21, Samuel spoke to him. Saul answered and said, am I not a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least, meaning not very many members, of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you speak to me like this? You see, Saul didn't see himself worthy as being a king or a military leader. He was small in his own eyes. Well, Samuel anointed Saul to become king, and he gave him specific instructions on what to do in his assumption of the kingship. And Samuel took a flask of oil, 1 Samuel 10, verse 1, and poured it on his head, meaning Saul's head, and he was anointed. Now, then King Saul was reluctant to secure his kingship. You would think somebody would want to go out and exercise his authority. I'm the king, I'm in charge, I'm going to go make things happen. And he didn't proclaim it saying, woohoo, I'm the king. Let me start with the number of orders I'm going to give. Instead, what did he do? He went home. He was looking for donkeys, and he was told to go home. Samuel told him, don't worry, your donkeys have been found. They're more worried about where you are than the donkeys. And so when Saul got home, he's newly anointed a king in 1 Samuel 10 and verse 14. He goes to talk to his uncle, and his uncle says, where have you been? And he says, well, I was out looking for donkeys. We couldn't find anywhere, so we went to Samuel to inquire of him. And the uncle said, please tell what Samuel said to you. Now, Samuel was a widely known prophet. And Saul said to his uncle, he told us plainly the donkey had been found. But he never mentioned the kingdom, and he didn't tell him what Samuel had said about becoming king. You see, Saul was reluctant to say anything about his anointing because he was small in his own eyes. He simply did not see himself as a king. Later on, when the battle came to Israel from their adversaries, Saul called upon the people of Israel to gather together, Samuel called the people of Israel together, and he was going to announce them that who was going to be their leader, and they couldn't find Saul. Where was Saul? He was hiding. This isn't a guy who was really proud of being the king of the people. And so we read this in 1 Samuel 10, and this story goes on. And Samuel said to his people, verse 23, they ran and brought him from there where he was hidden. And when he stood among them, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. So everybody else came up to his, up to the top of his shoulders. I knew that the first time I went to Asia. And then I recognized how Saul must have felt because most of the people there came up to my shoulders. So, well, that's what it's like. And Samuel said, do you see whom the Lord has chosen? There's no one like him among all the people. And everybody said, long live the king. Like King Saul, do we sometimes feel reluctant to take up the calling that God has offered to us? Are we embarrassed that God called us for a specific purpose? Later, it was when there was an imminent attack in Israel, Saul was indignant when this invading army said that they were going to kill them all, but if we make a deal, if you choose not to fight, then you won't lose so many people. We'll enslave you, we'll gouge the right eye out of every man, take all the women to ourselves and take all your stuff, but at least you'd still be alive. Sound like a pretty good deal? Well, Saul really hadn't assumed his authority at that point as a leader, military leader or kingship, but that was a bit too much to make the deal, to give away every man's right eye and to give away all of their women and take all of their stuff. So he sent the message out all over Israel and sent pieces of an ox and said, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't join together to defend Israel. So you have now Saul finally coming into his own, becoming a king. And now, of course, Samuel said, if you're going to be king now, you have to remember there are certain specific instructions you have to follow. You've got to follow God. Samuel didn't say to the people that they had to follow the king no matter what. Samuel said to the people they had to follow God no matter what, and that the king had to follow God no matter what, and that's the priority. First you follow God, or you will suffer. Well, let's go back to 1 Samuel 10. Samuel had given Saul instructions regarding sacrifices, and the sacrifices must occur before they went into battle. And so Saul had a standing army, which cost a lot of money and people, of about 3,000 people. And now this foreign army was coming against him. But Saul was told, you've got to make a sacrifice to God before this battle starts. But Saul was impatient. Samuel wasn't making it on time. What's the deal? And he was very worried that this other enemy would come and there were sacrifices weren't made. So King Saul did the sacrifices, the Levitical sacrifices himself. And then in 1 Samuel 13, in verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you've done foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God in which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you've not kept what the Lord commanded you. Saul made the decision to do his own thing, and he alienated himself from God. And there are other experiences, such as the fighting with the Amalekites and so forth. And this recall then, James 4, and verse starting in verse 7, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. You can't say you're on God, you know, going for God on one side, and then do your own thing against God in the other direction. Well, Saul wanted it both ways. He wanted to be king and do things his way, but he wanted God's blessings for doing things his way. And of course, we recall about King Saul kicking against the pricks, just like Christ told Paul, it's dangerous and it will turn out badly for you to keep kicking against the goad, meaning to offer vain and perilous resistance. Well, it did turn out badly for Saul. He lost the authority for his kingship. Ultimately, King Saul lost his life, wounded in battle, and killed himself to avoid an ignominious capture and torture from death by being caught by the enemy. Because, you see, the enemy, when they find a ruler, they want to parade it over everybody, and they will torture them, make sure it's a slow death, an agonizing one, and everybody can see that the enemy is now ruling the country. And King Saul knew this was the standard, so he asked his armor-bearer to kill him. Do this, kill me now, so they don't drag this all out. And the armor-bearer wouldn't do it, so Saul then fell on his own sword, or he committed suicide. Well, we have other details about these two men, but I'm going to cut it quickly here. They bore the same name. In the Old Testament was King Saul, the son of Kish. And the other one in the New Testament was Saul of Tarsus, who became the great apostle Paul to the Gentiles. Both men were of the tribe of Benjamin, but in life and character they had a marked contrast. The first contrast, and there's about 10, even physically there seemed to be differences. In 1 Corinthians, one was tall and attractive and personable, which we read earlier when Samuel anointed him. And in other words, and the other one, in his own words, was unattractive. In 2 Corinthians 10, Paul says, who in presence am lowly among you. He considered himself lowly. In verse 10, they say, he was quoting others, that you are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible. This is what people thought of the Saul who became Paul, that his presence was weak. How awkward would that be? Well, yeah, you're a nice guy, but your bodily presence is weak and your speech is contemptible. A little awkward there. They didn't say it about King Saul. The second contrast is that Saul received a kingship in answer to the voice of the people. The other Saul was chosen by God, was a chosen vessel to serve God. In Acts 9:15, the Lord said to him, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. The third contrast, one gained this world's possessions only to lose them. That would be King Saul of Israel. The other one suffered the loss of all things, but he gained eternal riches. In Philippians 3:7, we read about the one who became Paul. But what things were gained to me, lest I have counted loss for Christ? Yet indeed I also count all things lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them as rubbish, that I may gain Christ. So the Saul of the New Testament was willing to give up everything for the work of God. The fourth contrast, then. One Saul began well. Of course, that was King Saul of ancient Israel. but he died a defeated man in suicide. And the Saul of the New Testament, the Saul of Tarsus, began badly. He was killing and dragging off Christians to prison, men and women, breathing threats and murder against the disciples and getting letters to have them thrown into prison. But Saul was renamed Paul, became a victor in the eternal perspective, because we read about him understanding the plan of God and how he could take part in it. The fifth contrast. One Saul was a kind and humble and genial man. We read that about King Saul, but then that same King Saul grew harsh and implacable and proud in spirit. You compare that to the Saul of Tarsus in the New Testament, who became Paul. He was once hateful and murderous by his own admission. In 1 Timothy 1:13, he said, "Although I was formerly a blasphemer, a persecutor, and an insolent man, I obtained mercy because I did it ignorantly in unbelief." The sixth contrast, the Saul of the New Testament, became wholly possessed of God's love and showed his concern for others. And you can read that through many of the epistles, particularly 2 Kings 5, or Chronicles, we'll get it right, 2 Corinthians 5. In contrast, King Saul degenerated into a fearful and hesitating person who was filled with mental torment. We read about that torment in 1 Samuel 14. Yet the other Saul, the New Testament Saul, was bold and positive in faith. In Romans 1:16, he said, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." In 2 Timothy 1:12, "For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I'm not ashamed." Well, we read the difficulties of Saul of the New Testament had to master and the challenges he had to go through simply to survive as a believer in God's ways. The seventh contrast was one of the Sauls was rejected by God. That would be the King Saul. The other Saul was caught up into glory by God. The eighth contrast, one was the object of pity and the other became the object of loving admiration. The ninth contrast, one fell on his own sword of suicide. The other one became an offering to the Lord. In 2 Timothy 4:6, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand." He likened himself to a container being poured out. It was nearly empty. In other words, he knew his life was coming to an end. And according to our understanding of history, the Saul of the New Testament, Paul, became a martyr for Christ, then killed by the sword. The tenth contrast, one was deliberately disobedient to God's word, which he knew became known, and lost an earthly crown. King Saul was given an opportunity to lead and to rule, but he turned his back on it. The Saul, or Paul of Tarsus, once he understood the truth, he chose to become obedient to the best of his ability and gained a heavenly crown. The lives of these two men, the two Sauls, about 1,000 years apart, are examples set forth for us. And it gives us the consequences of the sin of disobedience and the blessing of wholeheartedly following God. So which Saul do we mostly represent? Which one do we resemble? God chose King Saul, but King Saul didn't choose God. King Saul kicked against the pricks. The Saul of the New Testament, who became the apostle, also kicked against the pricks, but he also responded to the calling of God. So the lesson from the two Sauls is to follow the instructions of God and quit kicking against the pricks.